Try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait. Will this send me spiraling out of my routine?
Time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your metabolism. Drink butter coffee instead to kill cravings.
What? Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning, right? Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again?
Fruit ruins
Never
insulin
Never eat after 7 p.m.
One cheat day.
Cut carbs by
30 Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear. Just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. That's SIGNOS.com with code SPARK. Signos.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
Welcome back to Seven Deadly Sinners. This is part 2 on Bitter Betty Jane Whaley. Part 1 covered how Jane Whaley became the head of a cultist church with no formal training and an escalating ego. We covered her radical and abusive practice of blasting and how normal everyday people like the Cooper family got sucked in. We left off on how Jane's insane ideals were worsening and her stronghold was tightening. But it's only going to get worse in part 2 today. The blasting attacks on congregants were excruciating. The book Broken Faith chronicles Evans, a man with plans to expose the church. He infiltrated them and posed among them to gain information. And he gave firsthand accounts of the brutal blastings like this. Evans witnessed fussy children taken into a tiny bathroom to have their demons exorcised. Screams at the infants could be heard down the halls. During one Sunday service, he witnessed the entire congregation, hundreds of adults and children, blast a 6-month-old baby. Prior to this, Evans was given his first blasting. Jane Whaley finally noticed the new face in the crowd and pointed to him during one of her sermons and said, "You have a generational curse. We better get those demons out of you." And then he was surrounded. Ushers kept buckets nearby, and Evans soon found out why. The church engulfed him and screamed at the top of their lungs, a sound that could only come from a wild animal. They waved their arms at absolutely nothing and ear-piercingly said, "Devils, come out! We bind you, Satan! Get back! We rebuke you in the name of Jesus!" People began to shake him, and he got dizzy but tried to mentally remove himself from the situation. After an hour, he vomited in the bucket. And then, "Praise God!" the congregants shouted. They were satisfied with that. After he recovered, he attended a service that evening and witnessed a man vomiting up blood during his blasting. Torture was a daily tool used at Word of Faith Fellowship. But blasting alone was not enough to steer the Cooper family away from Word of Faith Fellowship. And they soon got their troubled sister back into the grips of the cult. Shanna Muse's initial introduction to Word of Faith Fellowship was in 1995. She was in need of a safe place to land after several turbulent years and 4 kids. So, she packed up her brood and drove across the country to live with her sister, Cindy Cortez, who had recently moved to Spindale, North Carolina, with her husband and children to join Word of Faith Fellowship. Now, all 3 adult sisters, Suzanne Cooper, Cindy Cortez, and Shanna Muse, were living in the small town of Spindale, a once-booming industrial spot at the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, full of working-class families who share a sense of pride in their pristinely maintained little town. According to the 2010 census, Spindale has a population of about 4,000 people, and 750 of those are Word of Faith Fellowship members. Think about it. Almost a quarter of the population are under the control of Jane Whaley. A control that was not about to sit well with the free-spirited Shanna. Asking her to conform to Jane's bizarre rules was like asking a sailor not to cuss. Rules that are given to you in a new member handout upon your approval by Jane to join the church. Okay, some of my favorite doctrines from this dictator are this. I mean, favorite meaning like they're just ridiculous. All right. So it's like 150 or something of them. Number 3. You will be required to smile on command. 41. Don't close your eyes when singing. You could give over to a religious devil. Number 50. Don't complain when the offering plates are passed more than once. Convenient, money-grubbing Jane. 79. Don't accept a job unless you check it out with authority. 80. Don't make plans for college unless you have Jane check it out. 81. Don't sign up for classes unless Jane Whaley or leadership checks out your schedule. 82. Don't buy a house unless Jane Whaley can check it out. 83. Don't even make an offer on a house unless Jane can check out and get a feel for the neighborhood. 84. Don't decorate your house unless Jane or her helpers can help you. 110. Don't play Monopoly. No reason. 112. Don't ride in the back of a pickup truck. Sure, could be unsafe, but no reason. 117. Don't whistle. Okay. 118. Don't let Word of Faith Fellowship children play with children outside of Word of Faith Fellowship. Great, so it's a cult. 133, don't start a relationship without checking it out with Jane. 134, don't decide who you will marry without checking it out with Jane. 137, don't complain about the list of don'ts. 144, don't attack those in authority. And 145, don't question Jane's authority to run Word of Faith Fellowship. So I guess I was wrong. It's not 150 because that is the final rule, and at least the list I saw. Don't question Jane's authority to run Word of Faith Fellowship. Between the bullshit rules and her sisters Suzanne and Cindy, along with church leaders constantly criticizing their black sheep sister Shanna and telling her she needed to repent at every turn, Shanna didn't last long. She moved back to Florida, where the three sisters were originally from and their mom Wanda still lived. Little did Shanna know, though, that years later, she would be sucked back in with no easy escape this time. The cult had grown stronger and their tactics more and more predatory. You see, Shanna Muse was the perfect victim. Jane Whaley and the Word of Faith Fellowship prey on the lost, the lonely, and the addicted. And Shanna was all of those things, and she had been for years. Her journey with drugs and alcohol began in middle school, with cocktails of vodka and orange juice that eventually led to drugs by the 11th grade. Cocaine was her drug of choice. Then, eventually, she graduated to the highly addictive crack cocaine. While bouncing around from place to place, she met the first of her children's fathers, Khalid, a Saudi college student from a wealthy family. And although Khalid made it clear that he would be moving back to Saudi Arabia after graduation, Shanna didn't tend to think that far ahead and enjoyed the moment. Their daughter Sarah was born, and 5 months later, Khalid was gone. Then a second blow. 2 weeks after Khalid left, Shanna found out she was pregnant again, with her second daughter, Rachel. With all the chaos, however, she did manage to become a nurse. And soon after that, she met Vincent, the man who would give her her two sons, Patrick and Justin. This was the inciting incident before her first move to Spindale. The relationship was rocky with Vincent and unhealthy for the young family. So she fled to North Carolina to be close to family. With no desire to conform, however, she was soon back to Florida and back in a haze of drugs. And within 3 months, she had lost her job, her house, and her children were sent to live with her mom, Wanda. This still yet wasn't rock bottom, though. That came in the year 2000, when Shanna found herself locked up in jail for writing bad checks. Fraud to fund her drug habit. She had no money, no booze, no crack, nothing to help her forget. No cigarettes to ease her shaking hands. She had nowhere to turn. No foreseeable hope of a way out of the mess she created. She was vulnerable and she felt her chances with her mom had run out. She had already taken her kids in time after time when Shanna got herself in trouble. But like a beacon of light, she heard these words. "You have visitors," one of the officers said in the jail. Shanna looked up to see her two sisters, Cindy and Suzanne. "We're going to get you out of here," Suzanne vowed. "But we want you to come back with us to North Carolina. Get yourself together, and then we'll help you get custody of the kids. But first, right now, you have to get right with the Lord." And in that moment, she knew. If she was going to get her kids back, she had to play by the rules, no matter how insane they were. She had to suck it up, get back in Jane Whaley's good graces, play the part of the loyal servant, and then everything would work out. Or so she thought. Wanda and her daughters hired an attorney for Shanna. She was placed on probation and given the go-ahead to move to Spindale. Suzanne was also granted temporary custody of Shanna's children, and they too were allowed to move north. Shanna was extremely apologetic to her sisters and her mother. She knew she had messed up for the final time and was grateful they stood by her. So Shanna got a job at the plumbing parts factory owned by church leader Kent Covington, earning just $8 an hour for very dangerous work as a machine operator. Suck it up again, she thought. She just needed to get her kids fully back in her custody. Shanna, Suzanne, and other members helped to spin a narrative that the children were living comfortably, not cramped in two twin beds in the hallway of Suzanne's house. So they sent photos of other children's furnished bedrooms and claimed the kids were living there. They also sent them the Word of Faith Fellowship school curriculum with shining reports of the children's educational progress. The social workers were impressed and also thrilled with Shanna's sobriety, passing regular drug tests and working a full-time job. So they granted her full custody of her kids. The reality, however, was bleak for the children. Yes, Shanna was sober, and as loving and as supportive mom as she could possibly be, her kids were constantly ridiculed and belittled by Jane and other church leaders, calling them wicked and forcing them into free labor, and often beating them and blasting them. But Shanna was stuck. She couldn't stand on her own 2 feet yet financially, but she also wasn't going to allow herself to be brainwashed by Word of Faith Fellowship, so what could she do? I mean, it had gotten so much worse. It had been 6 years since Shanna set foot on the Word of Faith Fellowship compound grounds, and she was shocked. It seemed with every passing year, Jane's grip tightened and rules more intense. The members were completely isolated, and the church was all they knew. A common cult tactic. Leaders isolate people, so they are the only one feeding them information. Jane positioned everyone not inside Word of Faith Fellowship as lecherous devils, willing to lie and cheat to get their family or friend out. The church controlled everything, from where they worked, usually for a Word of Faith Fellowship church leader. They were also required to do work projects for free, which was often maintaining and upgrading Jane Whaley's home. Marriages had to be approved by Jane, and after they were married, they weren't allowed to come together, have sex, until the elders decided it was okay. But that was just the beginning of an ever-evolving boulder of control. Jane was rolling down her judgmental mountain, and with every new piece of people's lives, she found more ways to control. Her addiction to power only got worse. She needed more and more dominance over people's lives to get her fix. That, coupled with the fact that she was getting away with it, only proved to Jane that she was unstoppable. There are a lot of great true crime podcasts out there, but nothing like Murder in House 2. I am enthralled. I think I walked maybe 6 miles today just so I could listen to 3 episodes back to back because I couldn't stop and I didn't want to be around family or friends. I was like, I just need to listen to this. Do you remember, okay, the Haditha massacre in Iraq back in 05? 24 Iraqi civilians, including women and kids, killed by U.S. Marines in cold blood. It kind of went away. Nothing to see here. Move on. Well, it didn't go away. For Academy Award-nominated U.S. film director Michael Epstein, he has spent the last 15 years obsessively searching for the truth. So much so that he got himself on the defense team of the Marine charged and recorded everything. He goes back to Iraq where it all happened with this guy, Frank Wooderich, including into the bedroom where 5 kids and 2 women were slaughtered by his squad. Frank tells him what he remembers. Epstein speaks to other soldiers involved. The stories don't quite match. The most amazing interviews are with the NCIS agents who are trying to piece together bit by bit what and what happened and who was pulling the trigger based on a site visit cut short by enemy fire. I've listened to that episode. It is intense. And some haunting photos of the aftermath of the massacre. No spoilers here, but it is a story those at the very top of the military and government do not want telling. It is the number one true crime podcast in the UK, made by an American about the US military. So why isn't it number one over here? Please check out Murder in House 2 wherever you get your podcasts. You will not be disappointed. The rules of Word of Faith were ever changing. The isolation I mentioned earlier, but now it was no radio, television, magazines, or newspapers. Nothing was allowed, and no one dared to object. Birthdays were no longer celebrated, holidays totally off, especially Christmas, because that's a birthday and a holiday. Suzanne and Rick Cooper were having second thoughts about their involvement with the church, though they wouldn't admit it to one another. Neither would open up about their mistrust of Word of Faith in fear that the other would run to Jane. Rick still believed their marriage could be saved, but Suzanne knew it was beyond repair. They had the same old issues, money, employment security for Rick, but they carried on day after day with the momentum of normalcy. Finally, after a neck injury that Rick needed surgery for, the couple found themselves alone in the hospital. And maybe being in a vulnerable state or with the pain meds lifting his defenses, Rick confessed his true feelings to Suzanne. Rick said he was worried their children were being exploited by the church, and he had grown disillusioned by Jane's teachings. He believed Jane was corrupting the Bible's meaning. To Rick's surprise, Suzanne agreed. But for her, it wasn't about the teachings, but about their children. They had to get out. Suzanne was tired of the ridicule by Jane and church members about how she raised her children. She was tired of her children constantly doing work projects for church members into the late hours of the night for free. The Cooper son, Jeffrey, was a sticking point, though. He thrived at Word of Faith. He graduated with honors and could have gotten into any college he wanted. But Jane said no. He wasn't allowed to go to college, but that seemed to be just fine by him. Jeffrey was devoted to Jane, and she gave him special attention ever since he voluntarily confessed to having a schoolboy crush on a girl to Jane. Jane obviously scolded and blasted him, but used him as an example to encourage people to confess everything to her. Jeffrey seemed happy by Jane's side, doing odd jobs at her house, but it wasn't the life his parents had envisioned for him. If the Cooper family would flee, Jeffrey certainly would want to stay behind. They had a tough decision to make. But how could the family plan their escape without tipping anyone off? What if none of their children wanted to leave? The church had often forced children to turn on their parents, which sometimes landed the families in court. Suzanne wasn't confident where her other children stood. The last thing they needed was a custody battle. And then there was the question of where they should move. Should they stay in the county or move further away? Florida was the obvious choice, and Suzanne's mother, Wanda, would be thrilled. Suzanne and Rick hadn't told their kids the plan yet, but they confided in Suzanne's sister, Cindy. To Suzanne's shock, Cindy agreed they weren't being treated right. Cindy wasn't sure if she could get her husband, Steven, to agree, but she was thinking about making a move as well. With Wanda driving up from Florida for one of the children's graduation ceremonies, the timing was perfect. Wanda arrived and they downloaded her on the plan. Wanda smiled while sitting at their kitchen table. She was hopeful. Wanda had been waiting for this moment for a decade after her children had been nearly forbidden from calling or visiting Florida. Wanda said, "Stop calling it a church. It's a cult." No one could argue with her. When Rick received an unexpected call from a former Word of Faith member congratulating him on leaving the church, his stomach dropped. Despite all their careful planning, the Coopers had made critical mistakes and had told their plans to the wrong people. But who do you trust? But these people took the gossip straight to Jane. Word spread like wildfire through the congregation, and Rick was beginning to lose his nerve about fleeing. He was scared. Rick said to Suzanne, "I'm getting calls from the wicked already. I've changed my mind. I don't want to leave." Suzanne was overwhelmed by grief and fear. She was stuck. She wanted to get as far away from Word of Faith as possible because she knew it was only going to get worse. And their fears would only be solidified by what happened next. Soon after the gossip made the rounds, carloads of people were pulling into the Cooper's driveway via Jane's command. Dozens of church members invaded into the family's home, screaming and praying and splitting the family up for blasting sessions. Wanda looked at the flood of shrieking congregants, terrified. It was like a horror movie, watching them scream at demons and devils. Half of the unstable assailants then went next door to Cindy's house, and the same insane scene ensued. At the Coopers, Jeffrey was pulled aside by a church minister who asked if he knew what was happening. He didn't, but he had made up his mind he wouldn't leave. Jeffrey said to his mom, Suzanne, "Mom, you don't want to do this. We can't leave the church." What was Suzanne to do? She knew she couldn't force Jeffrey to leave. He was over 18, but she also knew that Jane would sever her relationship with her son. She couldn't risk that. Wanda, watching all of this, knew it was too late. The family was in too deep. The blasting continued at the Cooper house and at Cindy and Steven's family home for the next 2 days. Both families wrestled with accepting their fate. They had missed their chance. Shanna, the sister that they had recruited back into the church, was present at the days-long blasting sessions at her sister Suzanne and Cindy's homes. But it was the maniacal screaming directly into the ear of one of Cindy's children, a 4-year-old, that made Shanna realize she had had enough. She made it as far as the front door of Cindy's home when she realized she had no car, no house, no money. Her mother, Wanda, had left her behind. She knew in that moment that the rest of her family had changed their minds about leaving. She was trapped. Shanna didn't necessarily embrace the teachings of the Word of Faith. I mean, she didn't at all. But she had tried. She hated the rules, but she had stayed focused in order to get her children back. She quit using drugs and faithfully attended the church. But this incident with her sisters being violently attacked for days when they attempted to leave, coupled with the fact that at work one day, she had an overwhelming full-body breakdown. Shanna had had enough. Eventually, Shanna decided to try and leave, with the help of her mother, Wanda, in Florida, but always by her daughter's side. So one day, upon arriving at work, she told her boss, Kent Covington, you know, major church minister who we've talked about, that she was going to leave on Friday and she was taking her kids with her. He told her she was being selfish, that the boys would end up on drugs and the girls would end up in prostitution. The children had already been labeled by the church as misfits and were constantly in trouble, finding themselves being blasted and abused. The entire staff then joined Kent in blasting Shanna in his office. But she blocked out the noise. She was determined that this attempt to flee would be successful. When she arrived back at her sister Suzanne's home, no one was there. She couldn't find her children, so she called the police. Deputies drove her to the church, and Rick and Suzanne showed up shortly thereafter. At first, Shanna was happy to see her sister. Suzanne told the deputy that she could straighten out the matter. But as she spoke, Shanna's world turned black. "My sister has been abusive to her children. I have custody of the kids, so I cannot let her take them," she said. A lie coerced by church leaders in order for Suzanne to keep her own children safe. "What? That's not true," Shanna cried. "I got custody back a long time ago." Shanna continued to swear she hadn't abused her children, and she hadn't. But when the social worker arrived, both the sheriff and social worker apologized to Shanna and said, "Miss Muse, I'm sorry. My supervisor said we can't make any decisions until we investigate further. Because they say you abuse the children, I can't let you take them tonight." Shanna was beside herself and out of options. She turned to Kent and asked him if the kids could stay with him until they got it worked out. He agreed. Of course he did. In disbelief that her own sister would spread such lies, Shanna checked herself into a hotel and found herself quickly giving an interview to James Lewis, a local news reporter who had gotten wind that something was happening at Word of Faith and that had required assistance from law enforcement. So he tracked Shanna down, knocked on her door, and in a vulnerable state, she spoke. After talking with social services, who said that there was no evidence of abuse, though, and getting a sheriff's escort back to the church to pick up her children with Lewis in tow, Shanna heard the words she dreaded. Her children didn't want to come home with her. They were brainwashed. Shanna, at a complete and utter loss, called her mom. "Mom, they won't stop screaming. They say they want to go back to the church. I don't know what to do," she said. "Wanda, let me talk to him." Shanna handed the phone to Sarah, her daughter, Wanda. "Sarah, what's going on? Why is everyone screaming?" "Sarah, we don't want to be with her. We want to be with God." "But Sarah, your mother loves you," Wanda said. "No, she doesn't. She's trying to take us straight to hell," Sarah said. "Okay, Sarah, let me talk to your mother." Wanda was stunned. "Oh my God, Shanna. I don't know what to do, Mom. I don't want my children to hate me. I'm taking them from their school, their security. My nursing license is expired. I'm broke. I have no place to stay. I don't know what to do." "Sorry, Mom," she sobbed. "I'm going to call Kent and see if we can work something out." Wanda knew that was the wrong move, but nothing was going to change Shanna's mind. And Shanna called Brooke and Kent Covington. Out of options, Shanna asked Kent if the kids could stay with them until she figured it all out. And of course, you know, they're all in more control. It was a compromise Shanna hoped would please everyone, though. Kent offered to help her find an apartment, but needed her to sign a document to get the kids medical care in case they needed it. A notary public and members of the church presented a document to her that she signed under pressure without reading it first. Unknowingly, she had given Kent and Brooke their full custody. Life continued for Shanna, though. Not happily, but what could she do? The children had begun to call Brooke, Kent's wife, Mom, and referred to Shanna as Mama Shanna. They'd even changed their last names to Covington at the insistence of Brooke after saying to Shanna, "The girls have Arab names, Shanna. Don't you think it would be better to change them after 9/11? You could change your name to Covington too, so then your whole family will have the same name," Brooke said. "What a delight, Brooke." Shanna got a new job, and eventually the kids stopped taking her phone calls. And it wasn't surprising to Shanna when Jane Whaley appeared at her front door out of the blue one day. This was not a social visit. Jane was there for a reason, with a can of disinfectant in hand. Jane barged in and intrusively sprayed the noxious fumes into each room of Shanna's apartment and inspected all of the pictures on the walls. Jane informed Shanna she was never to step foot on church property again until she wrote a rebuttal in the newspaper taking back the lies. James Lewis had written that Kent was a kidnapper. He is. The article had appeared on the front page of the local newspaper. A light bulb clicked on in Shanna's head. Word of Faith had taken her family from her and were using them as leverage to continue to manipulate the town and the community into thinking they were doing good work. God's work. She was dialed in, but still didn't know what to do. Shanna's sister Sonia and her mother Wanda could see Shanna needed help and she needed it fast. Sonia had researched a deprogramming clinic in Ohio called Wellspring that helped patients that had escaped cults like Scientology. The clinic said they would take Shanna if she agreed to go. And she did. It was there she met Holly, another Word of Faith survivor, who shared eerily similar stories of abuse, manipulation, and shame. Shanna learned cult messages were different, but the practices were the same across the board. They controlled how members dressed, who they married, and who members could contact on the outside. They made it difficult to leave and frighten members into submission. Cult leaders were master manipulators, and Shanna realized what happened at Word of Faith wasn't her fault. After 3 weeks of intense counseling, Shanna began to process her overcoming of PTSD and began to see Word of Faith for what it really was. She learned her custody agreement was not legally binding, and soon, television news reached out to tell her story. When she returned to Word of Faith, she came, guns a-blazing, with reporters, begging the public for help and getting her children back. Quote, "My kids have been programmed, so I cannot get them to leave without assistance. But they will obey the sheriff or Kent or Brooke Covington," she said. But of course, the Covingtons fought back, coaching Shanna's children for an interview with a reporter for the Daily Courier. Sarah, the oldest of Shanna's children, said that they wanted to stay with the Covingtons. Quote, "They are the best thing that's ever happened to us," she said. I don't have the clip of Shanna's daughter saying that, but there are multiple current clips of members who had family escape that are now coerced and coached by Jane and the Covingtons into publicly denouncing their family member who escaped. Here are just a few examples.
"I'm here today because Jamie has gone to the Associated Press. And what he has said, even though he's very articulate and may be believable to you, but what he says is lies. There's nothing that he says that's true. Let me make it really clear. I am Jamie's mother. But that doesn't change the fact that I loved him. Jamie was not abused. And we certainly don't believe you can beat a devil out of anybody. He was not abused. He always exaggerated. He exaggerated anything that went on. He was extreme. He lied. And now he's with people that lie. So the lies have gotten bigger. What he's saying is not truth. He was never abused."
He's talked and talked and talked, and he's written so many things that are just false. They're not how we are. They're not how we live. And he claims to be an expert on cults, but he's an expert on nothing.
And we've decided up until now to be quiet because we didn't want to hurt him in any way.
What he believes is happening at the Word of Faith that really isn't happening at all. John Huddle has a vicious hatred for Jane Whaley. He blames her for all of his troubles. He says that she's a dictator, that she controls us all, but she really does not do that at all. She is kind and she's thoughtful and looking for the very best that she could see in anybody. He left because he didn't want to work.
We're a happy family together, and we really love each other, and we're happy.
But Shanna kept fighting, doing anything she could to get her children back, even joining protesters outside during a Wednesday evening service. Shanna stood in the rain, holding a sign that said, "Jane Whaley, set my family free." But Jane Whaley always has a clever counterfight. Suzanne listened to Jane rant and rave about going to court to fight for the kids. Take Shanna's kids away. Suzanne knew what was happening and she knew it was wrong. She felt horrible and disgusted for what she had done to her sister. But she had no choice. Her kids would have been taken from her if she hadn't. But she tried to be brave. And Suzanne attempted to change Jane's mind, saying, "Please don't take her kids." Jane glared at the meek woman and said, "Suzanne, this could have been you." And then brought up the time that Suzanne and Rick had tried to leave. Suzanne was ashamed, but relented. Jane eventually convinced the older daughters to emancipate themselves from Shanna. The court agreed, and Shanna's sons were sent to live with Brooke and Kent Covington. Jane won and destroyed poor Shanna's life.
South Carolina's got everything. Natural beauty, trendy cities, but you might miss your next big adventure in a smaller town. We've got you covered on the Palmetto Porch. Discover South Carolina's official podcast. I'm Devin Whitmire. Come with me as I venture off the beaten path and learn about these towns from the locals who know them best. Check out the Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, head on over to scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Shanna left heartbroken and went back to Florida. And unsurprisingly, her pain was just too much. The ultimate devastation for a mother had happened. For many years, her life spiraled again. But the hope of some healing might come one day. On the heels of another victory, Jane's evil continued to evolve. Jane's obsession with members' sexuality, relationships, erotic thoughts was her strongest all-consuming thought. No matter who you were, well, I mean, unless you're Jane, at some point, all members are accused, shamed for, and punished for masturbation, whether it occurred or not. Additionally, as most living, breathing adults know, masturbation is most often a private activity, so we have to wonder how Jane was even able to make these claims. Well, one way she did was just to randomly point to a Satanist rebel, a teenage boy doing absolutely nothing, and tell him to write down all of his unclean thoughts and activities. A futile task because he would be punished if he did or didn't have anything to write down. He'd be called a liar, and then a devil if he did write down anything. But they would honestly just make things up to appease Jane. And then, with their false confession a lot, Jane's punishment was basically torture, with Jane's hot old lady breath and spit enveloping their faces, and then even long stints at the lower building. A prison of sorts you'll hear about in a few minutes.
Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
And if Jane wasn't getting normal, innocent, hormonal boys to write down their sins, Jane would just make up a new rule to fuck with their poor heads. Imagine Just imagine being a teenage boy, having a normal reaction to sexuality, to your pants even rubbing in a certain way that you could create a reaction. And then you have to feel horrified and shamed because Jane brainwashed you to think that that meant you had the devil in you. Then Jane encountered the worst, unclean atrocity of all, a diabolical sight she witnessed while driving into town. A man standing with his hands in his pockets. The horror. I mean, obviously, we all know what's going on there. The man was masturbating. I mean, there's no other possible scenario. People don't just search for change in their pockets or cover their hands when cold or just even find comfort by placing their hands in their pockets. From that day forward, Word of Faith members were forbidden from putting their hands in their pockets. She decided that sexual demons were the most attracted to young people, too. Soon, young people weren't even allowed to speak to each other, look at each other, nothing, without a guard present. Swimming invited sin, so any co-ed swimming was out. But as much as Jane Whaley would shame her followers within the church, allowing them to get their own justice for sexual crimes against them was held to a different standard. When a 13-year-old girl told Jane she had been sexually abused by a church leader in his 30s, Jane's excuse to other people at least was, well, she looked at least 20, blaming the little girl for her abuse. But then she cooked up another form of control and torture, the lower building. Before I tell you about the nightmares of the lower building and how it was built and maintained, let me just remind you of something very important we learned in part one. That when just looking at the irony of it, you might be compelled to erupt into a bit of nervous laughter, which I did, at the face of Jane's brazenness, that she has to compare anything she's ever faced in her life to the Holocaust. Seriously. So much so that she felt called to build a Holocaust museum. That in and of itself is so unimaginably insulting, disrespectful, and frankly, so ignorantly evil that it's just hard to wrap my head around. Sorry if I stumbled over my words there, but it's shocking to me. Similar to the Jews, her victims were forced to work for free to build what would become their prison. I know it's on a smaller scale, I know that, but her comparing herself to being victimized like Holocaust victims were, but then doing the horrible atrocities of a tyrant. Jane Whaley is no longer a victim, or never was. She is the victimizer who, with the addition of the lower building, had truly entered the ranks of one of the worst tyrannical cult leaders. The dreaded lower building was hidden from sight on the Word of Faith compound, protected by a thick patch of trees and from the outside world's eyes. A perfect place to get away with some of their worst atrocities. The lower building was a one-story, four-room structure that was originally used as a school, then storage, but in 2010, it was revamped and reimagined into a place where men and boys were sent to deal with their sexual demons. This cramped space imprisoned up to 30 men at a time, sometimes for months, sometimes over a year. Living conditions were terrible. Beds were in short supply. At the peak, 12 sets of bunk beds were crammed into the rooms. But even then, some had to sleep on the floor. The men and boys were not allowed to communicate with their family or friends, and they were allowed only out when forced to perform free labor at nearby businesses owned by different church leaders. In an interview conducted by AP with 27 former members, one of them who had spent time in the lower building stated, "While there were no bars on the windows, people knew they couldn't leave," he said. He had spent almost his entire life in the sect before leaving in May 2015. Twice, he was in the lower building, and he watched people flee, but both times, the runaways were found. They were beaten upon their return, he said. You can't imagine the loneliness, the despair. You just wanted to... And then he stopped mid-sentence. You felt so hopeless you wanted to die. Jane's justification of this was that she had declared war on sexual demons in 2009, claiming that they had a spiritual epidemic on their hands. Too many men and boys are having sexual thoughts, and those Satanist rebels needed hardcore treatment to get their demons out. They needed exorcised with blasting, prayer, and isolation. Of course, this all began because of a perceived personal offense toward Jane, and her escalating obsession with sexual demons began after a worshiper confessed to having erotic thoughts about Jane's daughter, Robin. He said he had seen her exercising, and the sight of her bouncing breasts turned him on. Jane placed the man on discipleship. He was forbidden to speak to his family and attend church services. Usually, those punishments could have been served at home, but Willie decided to make an example of him, and he was the first man to be sent to the storage building. The man would have to clean it up and live there until ministers felt he had repented, she said. He spent more than a year inside. Jane and church leaders had invented a new form of deliverance. They were so proud of it, and the lower building began as a regular punishment. Jane and other leaders began separating men and boys from their families and imprisoning them. The anxiety of this spread like wildfire, and the brainwashed wives of Word of Faith members, they started reporting on their husbands. If a husband, for example, made unwanted sexual advances towards his wife or tried to have sex without being locked in, a dumb term Jane came up with to explain godly relations between a man and wife, they were then sent to the building. And Suzanne Cooper was not immune to this brainwashing, even despite her and Rick's attempts to escape. She was also so desperate to get out of her marriage, so Suzanne began reporting Rick's unclean thoughts to Jane. This went on for months. No amount of counseling with the completely unqualified and untrained church counselors was helping. Shocking, I know. Suzanne wanted out. Without asking for permission, she told Rick to leave. With nowhere to go, he went to his mother's house. A risky move by Suzanne to not consult Jane first. But when Jane confronted Suzanne about this, she seemed surprisingly sympathetic. But sympathy wasn't just Jane's motive. Her sympathy was a mask for the thrill she knew she would get out of handling the situation and throwing Rick down into the lower building. Jane told Suzanne she understood and that Rick was struggling to have a breakthrough. Jane told Suzanne that she would need help with the kids while Rick was away and said she'd send Kent Covington over, you know, the husband of Jane's foot soldier, Brooke, to discuss the plan. Rick spent a year in the lower building where he and others endured vicious beatings and were forced to listen to tape sermons by Jane Whaley around the clock. Okay, quick. Would you prefer, if you could choose, a beating or having to hear Jane Whaley's voice 24/7?
Devil! That's not what God said! From the throne of God. That was a part of the power of God that the devil...
Okay, I am joking. But it's classic cult programming 101. Isolation, sleep deprivation, shame, mind control, and unnecessary punishments in cruel conditions. And while unclean thoughts by single or married heterosexual men resulted in imprisonment and beatings, but an alleged unclean thought by someone who might be homosexual, you are beaten to the brink. You are beaten so badly that even in the fog of war could be considered chargeable as a war crime. And poor sweet Michael Lowry was about to experience this firsthand. Michael Lowry was a blonde-haired sweet kid who wore glasses. The church targeted and bullied him for his alleged slow, high-pitched voice that sounded like a girl and his effeminate nature. Leaders and Jane decided that he must be gay. And even though Matthew had no idea what gay even meant, he'd never had a girlfriend. He didn't even know if he was attracted to boys or girls. He was just Michael. But he knew that being accused of being gay was bad. really bad. He had experienced churchgoers surrounding and screaming at the top of their lungs, "Come out, homosexual devils!" Horrible inside the church, but nothing compared to the nightmare that would occur in the lower building. His first stint lasted 3 months in 2010, where he was choked, smacked, punched, and kicked countless times by others before church leaders sent him home. Because part of their tactics is, you blast and beat up someone else so you don't get beat up. Michael's parents were told their boy was hopeless. But in August 2011, he was sent back again. No one knew how long he'd be there. He had no idea. And his rules consisted of this: read your Bible all day. No talking, no eating without permission. And when they did eat, a tray was slid under the door in a hatch like you're in prison. If you have an erotic urge, start blasting. If you have a sexual dream, wake up and do the same. If you hear someone blasting, join in. And when necessary, beat the sinner to drive out their demonic spirits. He feared for his life. Michael saw boys thrown against walls and pounded on the floor by groups of men. One night, Michael was forced to sleep outside the building with no coat. The temperature had dropped into the low 40s. He shivered all night. His feet went numb, but he didn't run away. He stayed, even though they made him feel, quote, lower than dirt. Then on one morning, when Michael stepped out of the bathroom, a group of congregants were waiting for him at the door. "Why did you take so long?" one of them asked Michael. "Were you masturbating?" Michael didn't know what that meant, but he knew how to answer. "No, I was just taking a shower." They didn't believe him. He had demons and he was going to hell. They jumped on him. They threw him against a wall, punched him in the face, punched his body. Others pushed their way into the bathroom, then Michael blacked out. When he opened his eyes, he was alone on the floor. It was getting no turn back bad. Michael and others knew to their core they needed to leave. But Michael wouldn't be the first or the last boy who was abused for having homosexual devils in him. In 2010, Matthew Fenner was forced to join the church at 16 years old when his family, seeking a cure for Matthew's problem, joined Word of Faith. Unlike Michael, Matthew knew he was gay and even came out to his family, a decision that landed him in the most abusive and life-changing position of his life, under the church and Jane Whaley's control. At 16, though, Matthew was wise beyond his years, and he played the part like a method actor in a Hollywood movie. He scanned the situation early on and developed coping mechanisms and skills to get him through. Danielle Cortez, Cindy Cortez's daughter, thought he was special. Not knowing anything about homosexuality or even heterosexuality and dating at that point, as she had grown up in the church, she immediately had a crush on Matthew. Though, as you could have guessed, they don't end up together romantically, but they will remain lifelong friends and survivors for the rest of their lives. Their escape and the scary aftermath will be discussed in part 3. But, you know, Matthew thought the church was a wild mess, but he did find friendship and friendliness in many of the other young people there. And then Brooke Covington took a keen interest in him, and eventually so did Jane Whaley. He confided in Brooke about his cancer diagnosis at 13 with melanoma and how he had beat it, but was always worried it would come back. He also talked about his mom being sick and living with his grandparents, his grandfather he adored. He felt relieved that Brooke was listening to him. It validated his struggles. Consistently making mental notes of what pleased church leaders, he treated his experience as a mental game, playing each part of what they wanted with the ease of Meryl Streep. When it was his turn to be blasted, he would fake a dramatic seizure, which thrilled the ministers into thinking he was being delivered. By his senior year, Jane Whaley had decided that young people could walk out a relationship.
which of course didn't actually mean dating or ever touching each other, but it was allowing people to date-ish. But he and his peers were expected to find mates, and Jay and other leaders were even starting to arrange relationships for young people, to the point where Jane bought engagement rings in bulk for them. For Matthew, this wasn't good. He knew he wasn't interested in girls. One day, Robin, Jane's daughter, entered their classroom and announced, "Is anyone carrying anyone? If you are, raise your hand." Matthew, fearing his secret would be found out, raised his hand. He knew his mother wanted him to be with Danielle, and if he had to spend time with anyone, it would be her. They were friends. Danielle was fun and outgoing. "I feel like I should fellowship with Danielle," he said. Danielle was thrilled, and they began eating lunch together and sitting next to each other at youth socials. Matthew was now officially in Brooke and Jane's good graces, and they began taking him on the road when they toured with their Holocaust museum. Yep, she shamelessly spread her nonsense across America. But this is where Matthew, however, got to see Jane's hypocrisy firsthand. In the hotel rooms they stayed in, Jane and Sam watched TV. Matthew didn't care to question it. He thought it was pretty funny. But Jane had the perfect excuse, as she always did. She brought their dog on the road, and she didn't want people to hear it bark. Eventually, though, Sam and Jane would just flip through the channels with no apologies. He also got to see another evil side of Jane. She would get off the phone with a church member and basically call them bumbling, naive fools, and then turn around and accept love gifts from them, which was just money, jewelry, anything to show Jane their appreciation. Eventually, Matthew's family moved in with the Covingtons, where Shanna Muse's family also lived, including her son Patrick. They became fast friends. The two bubbly boys would talk about movies or music they had seen before entering the cult, and they dreamed about things they'd like to do someday when they left.
"Want to try a free sample?"
"Oh yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts."
"You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos."
It didn't take long, though, before the church noticed their flirty undertone and said the way they interacted was ungodly. One day, in 2013, Matthew was working in the laundry room of the Covingtons' house, alone, when Patrick walked in the door and closed it. They immediately held each other and then kissed. It was thrilling, but they knew they needed to be discreet. "We need to go," Matthew said. "If they find us, we'll be in trouble." Things escalated in another encounter between the boys. I mean, personally, I'm thrilled for them, but I know the danger that lurked around the corner for them. Danielle, being oblivious to all this, was pulled aside by Brooke and told that she needed to deal with Matthew's problem. Brooke said, "You need to deal with his sin. If you don't do something, he's going to leave the church. If that happens, his blood will be on your hands." Danielle, being a teenager and had been locked up in a cult most of her life, nodded, having no idea what she was talking about. Later, one night after church, Matthew was taken aside by Brooke and two other leaders. They asked him to open up about the sin in his life. At the same time, another leader accused Danielle of having perversions for her sister, meaning their relationship was too personal. "You need prayer." Danielle knew exactly what to do. She went through the motions, listened to the screaming, confessed her sin, and had a breakthrough. When it was over, Danielle noticed a commotion across the room, where a growing number of people had surrounded Matthew. They were screaming, blood-curdling noises in his face. Danielle rushed to him, wanting to help. She had to think fast. Matthew was seated in fear, surrounded by nearly two dozen people. Brooke was pushing on his chest, screaming, "Open your heart!" Another slapped him hard in the face, leaving four red fingerprints on his cheek. Before he knew what was happening, Matthew was being shoved and punched. He weighed only about 130 pounds, and a week earlier, doctors had taken a biopsy to ensure his melanoma hadn't returned. The way you hold your hands, the way you cross your legs, that's all homosexual devils. We're going to get it out of you, Brooke screamed. Do you have homosexual thoughts in a dream? Did your body manifest? Of all the blasting Danielle had witnessed over the years, this instantly seemed more frightening, more hysterical, and clearly more violent. Then the inevitable happened. Brooke screamed at Danielle, "Get over here and deal with your friend." When Danielle approached, Brooke shoved her into the middle of the circle. Matthew was crying and pleading, shaking his head, denying he'd done anything wrong. Danielle had to do something or she'd be in the same spot. "Matthew, you better tell your sin," Danielle said. Others joined in. "Come out of him, you wicked demon. You're so wicked. You disgust me. You're going to die and go to hell. You Satanist. You're going to burn in hell." "He's not saying what his sin is," Brooke exclaimed. Then a male member grabbed Matthew and began beating him in the sternum. Another male stood behind Matthew with his hands wrapped around his neck, shaking hard. With every line of the prayer came another blow to Matthew's chest. Matthew felt frail. All he thought was, "Is my neck going to break? Am I going to die?" Danielle thought he might. All the punching, slapping, choking, being thrown on the floor, he'd lost consciousness and had urinated in his pants. It went on for 2 hours. Danielle couldn't watch anymore. A member was choking him, so she slid her hands under his fingers, trying to peel them off. He looked at Danielle with wide eyes, you know, getting ready to tell Brooke that Danielle was interfering in God's work. But quickly, she thought, "Matthew's had a biopsy on his neck. Adam, wait, wait, wait. He just had surgery, remember?" She perhaps saved Matthew's life. The man pulled his hands away, and Matthew finally got his breakthrough. He panted on the floor, dripping with sweat. His face was ghostly white, and his eyes were dark and sunken. To Danielle, she said he, quote, looked like a dead person. The crowd broke up. Danielle helped Matthew to his feet and helped him get home. And just like Michael Lowry, who vowed he would escape and tell the world of the lower building and the extremely brutal and dangerous cult created by Jane Whaley, tucked into the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, Matthew Fenner knew he needed to get out too and get justice, or the ultimate might happen. They could kill him. After the brutal beating, back at home, Matthew stopped Patrick in the hallway and confessed he was leaving. Patrick didn't hesitate. "I'm coming," he said. In part 3, we will cover Michael's triumphant escape and then kidnapping back into Word of Faith. The mysterious deaths of 2 advocates outside the church, the escapes of Patrick, Matthew, and eventually Danielle, the Cooper family's long walk back to freedom and family, and the aftermath of many escapees and the mental trauma they endure to this day. And finally, the ominous potential for Jane Whaley's control to reach Jim Jones and Jonestown Heights. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate that you're on this journey with us. This is nuts, but you guys are the best. And if you're enjoying the show, the best thing you can do to support is to leave a 5-star rating and positive review. Not only does it, you know, make my life, I get nervous, like even looking at it, I'm like, please tell me everyone likes me. But thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And tell a friend. If you're enjoying this, reach out. I love hearing your guys' stories. I feel like so many people have not come up with, but reached out and said, "Oh, I was born in a cult," or "My grandparents did this," or "We gave all of our money away to these, you know, psycho televangelists." So I really appreciate your interaction and your love. And I want to give a thank you to Kate Codman, who has been helping me with research and writing, and obviously Greg, the editor. And anyways, thank you guys so much for listening. Bye. 7 Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.
there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes, too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.